Hey there, lovely folks. You are tuning into CITR 101.9 FM, your campus connection based here at the Point Grey campus. Remember, we are here on the ancestral, unceded, and traditional territory of the Musqueam people, and we honor that every time we hit the airwaves. It's Monday high noon, and you know what that means. It's time for our weekly news radio show, Against the Current. I'm Ankita Goyal, your new news collective lead, and I'm super stoked to be leading the news collective for the academic year 2023-24. I'm also super stoked to be a part of this journey with you all and with the incredible team here at the station. And guess what? For today, we've got a hot topic on our hands that's hitting close to home for many of us right here. Now, if you're a student like me, navigating the maze of assignments and rent payments, you know it's not just about finding the right citation format. It's about finding a roof that won't break the bank, right? So we are talking about the housing affordability crisis, folks. The struggle is real, and especially for us international students. But fear not, today we are going to roll our sleeves and tackle this issue head on, dissecting it, and fingers crossed, maybe we'll find some solutions on the way. So Vancouver, our beloved and bewildering city, is not just known for its stunning skyline and epic mountain views. Apparently, it's got a notorious reputation as one of the least affordable places in the world. We are talking a housing affordability ratio that's just off the charts. A jaw-dropping 11-13, well, that's just past the seriously unaffordable mark. So let's break down the current situation. Number one, we are running low on family-friendly housing and townhouses that just won't break the bank. Well, it's easier to say that they're as rare as unicorn sighting in a Stanley Park. And if that's not enough, rental rates are skyrocketing, practically launching folks out of the real estate market. Secondly, low incomes have become the norm, thanks to an alarming shortage. Well, imagine trying to build a sandcastle with a teaspoon. Well, it'll just not work out, right? And as of number three, the competition for land is hotter than a July heat wave, my friends, driven by a relentless shortage. Number five, it's all about a supply and demand tango gone wrong. There's just not enough housing to go around. Well, now let's talk about the facts related to UBC. Well, UBC's got a grand plan to build 4,800 new housing beds, and they are cracking open the piggy bank to the tune of $1.5 billion. Yeah, that's a billion with a B. And do you remember that Everest-sized housing waitlist at UBC? Well, you think it's long right now, but it's been trimmed down to 5,000 students from a peak of 8,000 in July 2022. Well, that's progress, but the struggle still remains real. Now, when it comes to the beds for students, UBC's got a room for just 28% of those enrolled in classes. Well, meanwhile, our friends over at SFU can only offer beds to measly 7.5% of their students. So yeah, just know the fact that we are not alone in this. Talk about financial hardship. So it's an unwelcome roommate for a whopping 57% of UBC students, and all thanks to the soaring housing costs. But hey, it's not all doom and gloom, right? Our city isn't without its charms, especially when it comes to East Vancouver. It's the place to be for students hunting for unique, budget-friendly neighborhoods. And yes, as you know, most UBC students living off-campus rely on transit, bikes, or their trusty walking shoes to navigate the city daily. Well, but the million-dollar question that arises is, what's being done to tackle this housing crisis situation? Well, a while ago, Vancouver did lay out an ambitious three-year action plan. However, as we step into the crisp of October of 2023, the crisis still looms large. So let's get ready to unravel the mystery as we dive deep into the heart of the matter with our guest. So we've got a fantastic guest here with us today, Michael, who is a seasoned expert in urban planning and community development. Until 2018, he served as the senior downtown planner for the city of Vancouver. Michael has also been an adjunct professor at UBC for almost 24 years now, teaching housing and community planning policy. He has an impressive track record, having been elected the president of Canadian Institute of Planners in 2013. Michael, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to be here.
So let's dive deep into the housing crisis of 2023. All right, starting with the first point, Michael. So one hot topic in the housing crisis is the narrative of immigration. Critics often point fingers at newcomers as the cause of the housing crunch. However, a lot of analysts argue that this blame disguises the real problem. Can you please shed some light on this issue?
Sure. Well, first of all, when we talk about what we describe as the housing crisis, it's different things in different places. So what we do know is that, for example, the Greater Toronto Area and Metro Vancouver and Montreal are significant destinations for many of the immigrants moving to Canada. And if we're looking at where is the growth happening in terms of the size of the community and the number of households, definitely it's significantly driven by international immigration for those cities. Certainly women aren't having as many children as they used to have. And the primary source of new households used to be families having children and children growing up and then going off and establishing a household. But now it's immigrants.
All right, that's an interesting perspective and it's crucial to address, right? But like you mentioned, family housing. So the city has been falling short of its target to make new units affordable to housing earning less than $80,000 per year, right? And housing for at least 7,000 families with children is an unmet need in Vancouver specifically. So how will you elaborate this and how do you think that, how important is it to address the needs of families when it comes to housing?
Well, first of all, there's a variety of households. And when we talk about a housing crisis, for example, in the Greater Vancouver area or Toronto, Montreal, there's a lot of focus on the what. The what being housing targets and housing as either a house or a townhouse or an apartment, and not a lot of focus on the who. So, for example, if we look at the variety of households, let's look at this really broadly. For example, one of the things that I researched in the last year is the demographics of poverty. Because clearly amongst the biggest needs, who are like the folks that aren't necessarily going to be able to afford to rent or buy a home in the communities I've mentioned. Now, it's interesting, in generally across Canada, deepest levels of poverty are amongst people between the ages of 45 and 64 who are living alone.
Oh,
yes. So when we look at affordability for a household, and let's call them households because we have a whole variety of different types of households. So for a household, that's on a limited income and living by themselves and maybe without family ties or a friendship network, they really struggle in expensive housing markets. And then the next group, that group's about 25% of Canadian households are in that age range living alone. Next, you have single parents living alone, disabled, and recent immigrants. Now, first of all, when we talk about immigrants, we have different types of immigrants. We have immigrants who come to Canada through applying, you know, to immigrate to our country. And they're actually, as immigrants go, pretty well set, because generally they come over as a family, and you have more than one person earning an income. And quite often they end up, for example, India is our major source of immigration, at least in more recent years. They'll end up in a place like Surrey. And because you've got a couple of brothers living with their families, maybe an aunt is living there, you've got a number of incomes coming in, so they can afford to buy a house. So you also, in terms of immigrants, you've got asylum seekers, people who arrive here seeking asylum. They are definitely more challenged. They're not, because see, they haven't gone through a process of, well, do you speak English or do you speak French, or what skills and trades do you have? Where in fact, you know, oh, definitely there's a job market there. So that's more challenging. And then you have refugees. So those are very broadly the three groups of immigrants that you have. And some immigrants are better set to establish a household and a home for themselves, and others are more challenged. The next group that's very challenged are single parents. And we know single parents are generally women. Now, I was looking at the statistics the other day, thinking about our talk, and imagine a woman with a child that's waiting on tables. So here's somebody that they don't have a university degree, they don't have a trade, they work in a restaurant. So what kind of money do they earn? Well, in Vancouver, we have what's called the living wage. It's around $25 an hour. If you do the math, working 40 hours a week, maybe sometime off during the year, paid holidays, hopefully, 52 weeks. So if you look at how much money, and then ideally they're paying no more than 30% of their income, their household income, gross income on shelter, anything associated with housing for them and their child, they end up with about $1,200 a month they could afford for rent. Now, let's just pause for a moment and think, two-bedroom apartment in Vancouver for $1,200 a month. It's probably unlikely they're going to find that. So probably they'll maybe live in a studio or live in a one-bedroom in an older building, but there's very few apartments for that cost. And then the other group, that sort of are about the same proportion of poverty, are the disabled. So you have somebody that really can't, be working very, very much. Maybe they're living on a disability pension or something. So they really struggle. Many of them are living in poverty. So when we talk about a housing crisis, different types of households are facing different needs. What I thought was also very interesting in looking at the research is just a little bit below, in terms of a percentage from the groups I just mentioned, are Indigenous communities, Indigenous households living off reserve. However, I also sought out, well, what's the statistic for Indigenous households living on reserve? Wow. I mean, even higher than single attached older folks living alone. 43% of Indigenous households living on reserves are living in poverty. Boy, that really, makes you pause. So those, when I looked at the targets, I thought, well, how well served are those groups going to be served? And I have reservations about that, because what was missing for me in the targets was targets for social housing for a broader range of households. I did see targets for supportive housing, which I assumed was social housing, which is good to see. But this is housing for people with medical issues, such as such as mental health and substance abuse issues and so forth. So we certainly we're building supportive housing in our community. We did have a column for something labeled below market. But the problem is that, let's say you're a single mom with the child. She's got if she spends 30% of her income, well, she's not going to find something unless it's social housing, unless it's subsidized housing. And that means subsidized by the provincial or federal government, housing co-op or nonprofit housing or something. So when I looked at the targets, I thought, well, it's great to see below market. Generally, they're talking about 20% below market. Well, let's say rental, let's say $4 a square foot per month. Well, you do the math, and the single mom would ideally be looking for a two bedroom. So let's say that is 700 square feet. So that's 2,800 square feet a month. Older, not one of the newer apartments. Newer apartments are generally could be around $5 or more, $4.55 up to $6 per square foot. You do the math again, $4,000 a month for a two-bedroom apartment when they're building new. So that's why with the City of Vancouver, with their moderate income, purpose-built private market rental was through a rezoning and density increases requiring some below market. But market is not necessarily reflecting what low and moderate income households can afford. Because a renter in BC will have their rent control. And I have a number of friends who are elderly or disabled, living on limited incomes, and they can afford to live in Vancouver because they've lived in their homes for 10, 15, 20, 25 years. So because the rent increases are limited to something close to inflation or more, or the cost of maintaining the building, they're well set. So rent control is important. And as I say to my friends of low and moderate income, stay where you are. If you're happy where you are and you've got a good landlord and they're maintaining the building, don't move, because then when you move, you're into what we call the market, which is significantly more expensive than what you're paying right now. So I think it's great the provincial government have got these targets, and we're looking at supply. But as I started off, the supply is focusing on the what, which is, is it a house? Is it a townhouse? Is it a one bedroom studio, two bedroom, three bedroom? But there's also the who. And certainly with my students this summer, we discussed that quite a bit, the who. And I went through a number of groups, have a variety of needs. Another demographic issue is going, and I'm very big on demographics, as I was sharing with my students back in the days when, I would working as a community planner for a city somewhere. One of the first things, okay, we're going to do a plan for an area. Let's look at the demographics of the community. How many children do we have? What's the proportion of tenants, homeowners, and things of that sort? So, where was I going with this? I got it. Okay. So, right now you look at the age sort of composition of our communities, and we'll notice we have a lot of millennials and we have a lot of Gen Y who are now moving into the time in life where they're meeting a partner and they want to have a family. They want to have children. So their housing needs are quite different than somebody, who's single or earns a good income or something. So that's very unique. So my take on the housing crisis is it's a number of things in motion.
Are you tired of Big Brother bookstores trying to sell you some billionaire's favorite book or Heather's top picks? Then you should check out Vancouver Books. Vancouver Books is a new online family-run bookstore. A portion of their profits go to First Nations reconciliation and environmental projects in British Columbia. They provide their customers with the most interesting books in fine arts, signed first editions, First Nations photography, fine ancient books, occult, and so much more. They also provide carbon-free delivery to anywhere in the Vancouver area. So go to www.vancouverbooks.ca to check out Vancouver Books today. That's www.vancouverbooks.ca. Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% Indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or Grocery Checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek
Coffee.
How are
you that Vancouver has a housing problem?
Mass eviction.
Mass rent eviction.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
One, and it's definitely this gap between what people can afford to pay and what the market is defined, and even 20% below market, which is what the housing targets have identified. There's still this significant gap between those who, for example, living on a disability pension or a single mom waiting on tables. There is a significant gap there. And I think that what we discussed this in the course as well, and that is ideally people who are anticipating having children would like to be somewhat ground oriented, maybe living in a townhouse or a stacked townhouse. Maybe I have quite a number of friends now who are couples who have children. It's interesting, they all live in townhouses. My friends who are millennials or younger, they live in apartments. But if they're families with children, they live in townhouses. Generally, all in East Vancouver, except for one who moved to North Vancouver. Another thing that, in terms of back to the who, that is significant, is that Andy Yan did an excellent analysis, and I share this every year, looking at what is being built in Vancouver and what income range of households can afford it. And he broke it down to this, you know, it really goes from the wealthy to people living on social assistance. So he broke it into, I think it's five groups. First of all, who is doing well? Who can kind of step into the market? Well, definitely people who already own property.
Yeah.
And the majority of people who are buying a home actually already have a home. So in the market. So see, that's worrisome, because then you've got the folks who don't own a home yet. So they're competing against somebody who's already got, a property, an apartment, or, you know, a house. So in any case, so you've got your first group is your wealthy. So you got your five groups. First group is the wealthy people. Oh, yes, sure. They've got lots of choices. The next group, which is quite interesting, and this speaks to the UBC grad students. This UBC students who have graduated that I was just referring to, because the social circle I know that have children, they're all UBC grads, because I got to know them through teaching at UBC. And in each of those cases, they're two income professional households. So I think for one thing that we discuss every year is to remember that students graduating with a degree and often into a profession are really in a very, good spot compared to other households. If you have a trade or something, you know, a plumber or an electrician, actually you're doing pretty well in that instance. But households these days are pretty well, you know, in this second group after the wealthy that can afford what has been built in the last few years. Now, the next group, it's where it gets starts getting a little dicey. And that's, you remember you mentioned $80,000 or less. This is when you get into a group we call the so-called middle class, which is very vague. But it's the middle class. You know, people say, oh, yes, the middle class. In any case, about half of them do about half of what he identified as the middle class in this income range. Then we get into what we call living wage, and that's the $25 an hour. And so, you know, if you were a woman working in a good restaurant and getting good tips, you probably could get the living wage. But wow, in the Vancouver housing market with a child, I mean, you're challenged. Then you're into minimum wage, $15 an hour. Oh, geez. I mean, you really, so, and then we're into people earning social assistance, right? And interestingly enough, they're doing actually better than the people working and earning a minimum wage, because we've been focusing social housing on groups that, you know, are homeless or near homeless, but not so much building homes, apartments, nonprofit, for, you know, minimum wage, living wage folks, and sort of that middle class group.
So. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yep. Oh, yeah. So in the targets,
yes,
I was looking for that. And because in my research, I've been focusing also on the who, that's where I have significant concerns about where we're headed.
Yeah, that's true, Michael. I agree that a lot of people just look at the housing crisis as a mere concept of supply and demand. But little do you know that when you get in the concept, it is more about how different demographics have different needs, right? So yes, that is definitely one aspect of it. But okay, so now that you've mentioned homelessness, right? That is a big problem here, specifically in Vancouver, right? And stats show that 57% of people believe that municipal governments have failed the homeless community in British Columbia. So what are your thoughts on the government's role in this, specifically homelessness, and the reason behind it? What?
Sure. Well, first of all, let's talk about roles of government and capacities of government in terms of revenues. And historically, it was actually the federal government, which has the deepest pockets, that was focused on the housing file in partnership with provincial governments. So they each would put their money together and then work with local governments. And often what a local government might do is provide the land for affordable housing. Well, what happened is that increasingly, the federal government in the early 90s stepped back and said, oh, we're no longer funding
affordable. Yeah, exactly. Back, I think they just started in 2017, right? The federal government re-engaged with the housing policy.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so the thinking in the early 90s was, oh, that's a provincial responsibility. And only at the time did British Columbia and Quebec at the time step up and say, okay, well, we won't do as much as we were doing with federal funding and provincial funding, but we'll still carry on an affordable housing program. So, for example, in Vancouver, we built quite a lot of seniors and families with children housing. That was the two types of households that were primarily focused, with the exception of the downtown east side, where housing was built for a broader range of households. Now, homelessness is a number of things regrettably coming together and creating this problem. First of all, just in terms of societal changes, we've seen a breakdown in families. And we've had more turmoil amongst families than compared to, let's say, the 1950s and 1960s. Secondly, see, we did something really interesting in Canada. In the 60s, with the Liberal Pearson government, they really stepped up. The vision at the time was the welfare state. So funding was stepped up for affordable housing, non-market social housing. Housing was stepped up for Medicare, right? So that's when we established socialized medicine. And third, there was something called the Canada Assistance Plan. And that's where the federal government across Canada said that provincial governments, we will match your expenditures on social welfare. And that would include a broad range of things, social assistance, but also mental health facilities. And they were funded 50-50. But then in the 90s, we've got a deficit. Oh dear, we've got to start cutting back. So what the federal government said, not only did they say in the 90s, well, we're going to pull back from funding affordable housing. They also said, yeah, we're also pulling back from the Canada Assistance Plan. So then we had another current, and my sister and my niece are social workers, and that was, let's deal with mental health issues in the community rather than in these large institutional settings such as Riverview that we have in Vancouver. So the thinking was that these new community-based facilities would be established, and we did not build significant enough facilities. So we deinstitutionalized folks, but we clearly had not provided the facilities. Now provincial government is now stepping up with supportive housing, which actually has coastal health folks working in the building to support those living in the building. And then we have the issue of drugs and these, the painkiller drugs and so forth that emerged in the last 20 years that were very, very addictive, right? So, a lot of these folks are single. Well, they're single, right? So they're separated from a supportive family. They're separated if they're not from Vancouver, from a friendship circle. And it's a big problem, but you've got a number of layers. And yeah, forces
they
that are
all prey to the concept of escapism, and then it's very difficult to get out of it. It takes a lot.
So this is another layer that's very worrisome. David Lay, who used to teach geography at UBC, did research where he looked at the affordable housing, that is, and particularly rooming houses, that were located in Kitsilano, the West End, Mount Pleasant, Fairview. And what happened with the advent of condos and redevelopment is most of those disappeared and were replaced by condominiums. And so increasingly you had areas along Granville Street and Hastings and in the downtown east side where you had these hotels that were still there, and you could rent a room, but of course those hotel rooms in many instances are renting at above the shelter rate for welfare. And then you have the challenge of folks that don't want to live within a structured environment. So this was something that I explored with a number of people who are working with the homeless. And they find it very difficult to deal with things like, well, you know, you can't have visitors after 10 o'clock. And, you know, if there's a curfew or something, and they really don't want to be living in an environment that's as structured as that. So it's a lot of wheels in motion here to address the problem. And also with it, for example, I was at a retirement dinner last week, and I was speaking to the executive director of an organization called Mission Possible. And what they do is really important. They find jobs for people that may have mental health issues or have been homeless, and in a sense set up a structure for them, a routine. And that's a lot of what these folks need, because what other routine are you going to have unless you've got a job or volunteer work or something like that?
Yeah, definitely. It's a complex issue. And like you said, it has many layers to it. And it requires for us, and especially for the government, to address it. And now going deeper into the policy landscape, so BC Housing, like you said, that it has been failing when it comes to, you know, projects or implementation of projects per se, right? So the challenges of ramping up the scale of nonprofit organizations to meet the scale of the challenge, the complicated model, like you said, the funding and the competition between each group, right, for funding and resources, leave it vulnerable and leave it very vulnerable for straightforward avenues for accountability. So could you share your insights on the accountability and effectiveness of this issue, please?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't say BC Housing is failing. I think if we look across Canada, relative to other provinces, BC Housing has been doing amongst the best, but they're still limited in their resources. But the provincial government has been putting more funding into supporting. And I would just, I think the support of housing is important, but I also see nonprofit, co-op housing, non-market housing is really important for those groups, for example, that I was mentioning to you, those households. I think, see, this is the difficult thing, is that we're hearing that local governments should be just saying, sure, you can come in and get a permit just like that. And the thing is that in most instances, you need to allow for an increased number of apartments and some increased height, which requires a rezoning. That what we observed in some neighborhoods is, even when we just had a policy that said you could come in for a rezoning, is that land values went up significantly.
Yes.
And there was one site, for example, the last plan that I worked on with my team was for the West End. There was one site that one developer bought it for $16 million. So it was three-story apartment buildings built in the 1950s on two 66-foot lots, and resold it for twice the value a few months later, and it got resold again, and it went from $16 million from an additional sale to about $65 million. Oh, my goodness. So the city, therefore, has said, well, look, we'll do rezonings, but we want to ensure it's going to be either an affordable building, or it's going to be what they call secured market rental, or it's going to be a nonprofit or something like that. Or if it's condominiums, that the city would get a share of the increase in the land value. What's in motion here is that, and I know we hear people saying, well, it should be just as of right. Well, the difficulty is that the densities are, the amount of floor space you can build is increasing so much.
You want to change the state of the world, but instead you keep buying material goods to satisfy whatever desire you have in that very moment? Me too. But now you can do both! Rock Shop and Community Thrift is a local vintage shop that fulfills your 1970s alt-chic fantasy while also supporting at-risk people through their compassionate and supportive work training program. All of their profits go to the PHS Community Services Society to support ongoing health care, harm reduction, and health promotion projects in Vancouver and Victoria. So stop by their two locations, Community Unisex on West Hastings or Community Frock Shop on Corral Street. And if you know any other local businesses that deserve recognition for their generous business practices or their contributions to the community, please DM us on Instagram at CITR and Discorder, because we would love to spotlight them. Because hey, if you can't stop buying, you might as well start supporting.
Are you looking for ways to be a part of the community through low-stakes opportunities like volunteering? What about making friends that are really cool or have some common interests? Well, I'm here to tell you that at CITR, you can come volunteer at Volunteer Wednesdays, happening every other Wednesday from 12 to 3 with a really fun activity each time, like making signs or button making. Not only is it a great break from outside stress, but a great opportunity to be a part of the community. For more information, you can visit CITR's Instagram page at CITR and Discorder.
Listen without distraction.
Listen to Breakfast with the Browns every Monday morning.
From 8 a.m. to 11 a.m.
Something that just offers you the place, the chance to stay in a mood.
Breakfast with the Browns.
The best in ambient, downtempo, electronic, ASMR, pop loungecore music. Totally Alpha Wave.
On CITR 101.9 FM.
Thus the most ordinary movement in the world may agitate 1,000-odd disconnected fragments, now bright, now dim, hanging and bobbing and dipping and flaunting.
So, beauty remains in the impossibilities of the body.
You know that, don't you?
That, let's say, if we increase the density you could do in a typical apartment building by 100,000 square feet. 100,000 square feet is about 20 stories. And in many instances, you're seeing. So that's 100,000 square feet. On a per buildable square foot basis, how much is the land on for each square foot of floor space that people are living in? When we first started doing Yaletown, we were assembling what became the park sites or some non-market housing sites for $18 to $24 a square foot. 20 years later, about 2007, a site sold on Howe Street for $300 a buildable square foot, $300. So it'd gone up, you know, more than 10 times. And then we had, previous to the pandemic, land on a per buildable square foot was selling for between $500 up to $700. Okay, so sure, we're just going to increase the potential density here. Well, 100,000 square feet, multiply it $700, that's $70 million. So the city has said, well, we want some of that so we can build affordable housing somewhere, or we need to expand the community center, put in a bike lane, build a park, right? But it right now it's controversial, and that's why we're hearing this. Well, it should just be as of right. But I believe the housing policy staff at the City of Vancouver would say, well, you know, you'll probably have, remember I mentioned those top groups, the wealthy, the two income professionals, and then half the middle class, sort of. So about half the households in Vancouver might be able to afford if we do it as of right. But then we've still got almost 50% of the households in Vancouver that can't really participate in the new housing that's being built. So that's really comes down to the challenge. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Michael. So that brings me to my last question. And that is that how do you think that pandemic and COVID has shaped the housing crisis that exists right now?
Well, again, it's very important when we use that word housing crisis that we notice and we think about it in terms of the who, not just the what. You know, we need a lot more housing. Well, it would affect people in different ways. It's interesting, during the pandemic, the federal government just decided, I remember watching the Minister of Immigration announce that they were almost doubling the yearly number of immigrants. And I was thinking, wow, now just a minute here. Weren't you thinking about the capacity of our builders, the number of dump trucks we have, the cranes, all these things that, and just the skill staff to build these homes, to just say, oh, we're gonna double the growth. So that wasn't necessarily pandemic, but I thought, oh, geez, that was during the pandemic. The pandemic was a difficult, I think it was a difficult time because it was a form of crisis and it's put us on edge. So we're more, I think as a society and households, we've become more anxious. So when we talk about the crisis, or we've got inflation, and see, inflation, for example, is looked at as an outcome of the some of the things that unfolded during the pandemic led to increased pressures on prices and so forth. So the pandemic will stand as a very significant 2 or 3 years, very stressful time for us, and layered on top of the stresses of raising your children, putting together the money for your tuition, figuring out where you're going to live. And also, we're social people. The thing that I and many of us found different, you know, I as a single person was told I can have two people in my bubble, right? And I thought, two people? I mean, I don't exactly, you know, want to go downtown to a dance floor or something, you know, in a crowded room. But, you know, I have my friendship circle and my family, and but they don't live in Vancouver. They live out of Vancouver. So I think for us, it felt more perilous for us because we rely on each other for support. We're not just individuals doing our own thing. You know? We need one another for support and someone to talk to and be with.
Exactly. And a lot of times I remember during the pandemic, it was said that the most problems are coming out of depression and isolating yourself. And yes, that was a major part of pandemic.
Yeah. So we have to be really careful when we use this word crisis, because I think of that, you know, the Titanic was a big ship and 1,500 people died. And I'm thinking, well, that was a crisis. You know? So the crisis, as I've shared with you, is different for different groups. And some, for example, particularly the wealthy, are less impacted. Property owners have more resources. Tenants in particular, I have a number of older friends who are tenants, and they feel vulnerable. So when we talk about a crisis, like, oh my God, let's you know, they just hope they can stay where they are. And then we have the millennials and Gen Y folks wanting to have families, going like, well, I was hoping to have a little garden and maybe like just a little area of grass. I don't need a huge backyard or a courtyard that's gated off where there's other toddlers, because I want to have children or something. So I think that's another side of the crisis. And then there's the side of the crisis where we go downtown and we're just, oh no, I mean, this person is just clearly really on tough times. You know, your heart just goes out for them. And they just seem to be more of them. So it's just different types of crises with different types of people, you know, for sure.
Yeah, it's more about, you know, a lot of people have their milestones set in life, and it especially comes to family. So yes, housing affordability per se is, yeah, is definitely something. And yes, like you said, housing policy is a critical piece of the puzzle. And just can you comment on federal government's involvement and considering they just started re-engaging with the public and with the housing policy back in 2017. Do you think that that contributed to the situation that is there right now?
Well, it certainly, I think we're better off that they have stepped in. And just big picture for a moment, remember you were talking about people being, let's say, critical of the city of Vancouver or other local governments. Those local governments do not have the resources to truly address the housing crisis. They can be partners in it, but they need the provincial and the federal government, who have access to taxes, sales taxes, and tariffs, and even most important, income taxes. So local governments, you know, they have fees, they can get contributions through rezonings, but otherwise it's property taxes, and you can't keep increasing people's property tax, because of course property tax aren't necessarily associated with how much income you're earning. Well, at least your income tax is related to your financial capacity. So definitely the federal government is, I think, playing a positive role. And I think we're very lucky with BC Housing and with the housing supply targets. As I said, my concern there is the who, and more social housing, more non-market housing, rather than a prime, you know, just focusing on the market. Because the market has, for the most part in Canada, really done a great job of providing housing for about, you know, 85%, 90% of your households. But then you have those households I've mentioned that are living in poverty that are very in a very stressful situation.
Yeah, that's true, Michael. I echo you when you say that, you know, it's a very complex situation. But in your opinion, do you see the future bleak? Do we have a bleak future in this? And do you think that it's a long road? And yes, we are reaching there. What is your opinion?
Well, I guess for a single mom with a child, my suggestion to her was, well, would you like to live in Regina or Saskatoon or Winnipeg? You probably could get by better there than in terms of having a larger apartment or even affording a townhouse or something. As far as Vancouver, I think most UBC students, because I know this is a UBC station, I think the thing that we need to face up to is, if we're going to live in Toronto or if we're going to live in Montreal or Vancouver, we're living in a smaller home.
Yeah.
But we still can have townhouse developments and stacked townhouse developments. For example, Commercial Street in the Grandview Woodland area, there's some wonderful examples of townhouse developments there that I think are very positive. But the concern, for the concern I have about the federal government is that, well, what's going to happen if we have a different party? And historically,
yeah, definitely that's
Yeah. And what I'm hearing from Pellevra is that he thinks the market can take care of it. I'm not hearing him talk about non-market housing and how we need to do a lot of that. So I'm feeling a bit bleak on that. I mean, I'm if it's a minority government federally, then I'm feeling less bleak. Because at least you'd have the NDP and the Liberals and probably the Bloc Québécois saying, let's do something more rather than just cutting, right? And it looks, and I'm feeling optimistic about our province is because it looks like our provincial government's is managing things pretty well. I'd just be encouraging them to do more.
Better than before, for sure, yes. Yeah. All right, that brings us to the end of the discussion, Michael. Thank you so much for taking the time out. And sure. Yes, what we've understood is that housing affordability is much more complex than we think it is. And like I said, it's not mere dynamics of the market. It's about who, and that question should be addressed first.
Yeah, it's so the who and the what. You have to.
Who and the what, yeah. So that's all for today on the episode of Against the Current. I'm your host, Ankita, and I can't wait to explore more pressing issues with you in the coming weeks. Until next time, stay informed and stay engaged and keep listening to Against the Current.